Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Thank you. Thank you.
Welcome, Max.
Thank you. It's a privilege for me to be at the Commonwealth Club. I remember many, many moons ago when I was a student journalist at the Daily Californian in Berkeley, I would go across the bay and cover events featuring important people at the Commonwealth Club, and here I am. So just, yeah. I suppose the implication is I must be at least semi-important now. So I.
The other implication is you're a left-wing radical.
Well, there is that.
Yeah. When did you go to Berkeley? What was that year period?
87 to 91.
Oh, that was peaceful then.
Yeah. Yes, it was.
Yeah, it really was. Well,
I'm also glad to have Roy as my interlocutor here, because our mutual friend Richard North Patterson said I had to get him, that he was the Willie Mays of interviewers, so no pressure, Roy.
That means retired. I'll try to live up to the audience expectations, because there's this book that you are now blessing us with is an amazing book because it has so many levels to it. First of all, a biography of such an interesting man, Edward Lansdale. Secondly, an insight into the early years of Vietnam. And third, it really provokes thinking about kind of what lessons did we not learn from that experience as a nation. So I'd like to try to get covering that mix of thoughts. But I think we need to start by you framing the main character of the book for us.
Well, Edward Lansdale, the subject of the book, was a very unconventional guy. And like a lot of other unconventional people, he was reared right here in California, born in Detroit, but grew up in Los Angeles. He was born in 1908, grew up in L.A. in the teens and 20s. Eventually, after dropping out of UCLA, and he went to New York to try to become a writer or cartoonist at the height of the Great Depression. That did not work out. And so, like a lot of other creative types, he got into advertising and eventually came to San Francisco, a city that he loved, and worked in advertising here prior to World War II. And so he had a background very different from a conventional military background. He did not go to West Point. He had basically no military education. He really came from the realm of advertising and psychological warfare. And another thing, he was also extremely informal, laid back, kind of a quintessential Californian. He hated neckties, hated bureaucracy, kind of a proto-Silicon Valley guy decades before the rise of Silicon Valley. And the other part of his upbringing that's worth bringing up briefly is that, of course, he grew up at a time of virulent prejudice, especially against Asians here in California in the 1920s, and he was never infected by that kind of sentiment. He always treated everybody of whatever race or ethnicity as being fully his equal, which was fairly unusual in his day.
And why do you think that was?
Well, the theory that I put forward in the book is that it had something to do with the fact that he was a minority himself, even though that he was a white, middle-class Californian. His family were Christian Scientists, which at the time was a religion that was very small. It's still small, but it was looked down upon at the time. It didn't achieve kind of mainstream respectability. And so I think he had some identification with outcasts and minorities.
Interesting. So then when the Second World War broke out,
he got the news a few blocks from here at his little house near Golden Gate Park, which still stands, which I visited. And he immediately wanted to enlist, like a lot of Americans, but he was overage and had some medical issues, so the Army wouldn't take him right away. And instead, he went into the OSS, America's first civilian intelligence agency, and spent the war years stateside, mainly in San Francisco and New York, interviewing travelers and getting information about these strange and wondrous places where Allied troops would shortly be landing, from North Africa to the exotic islands of the Pacific.
Hmm. And he would then translate that into basically tactical information for the
Yes, I mean, he would write up research reports, sort of being an ethnographer and geographer, yeah, describing these places based on his conversations, also recruiting some agents. Hmm. So he did a variety of things, and it wasn't until World War II was winding down yet millions of GIs were preparing to come home in the fall of 1945, that Ed Lansdale went overseas on his first permanent overseas assignment. By this time, he was already an Army officer, and he was eventually he would become an Air Force officer. But he was dispatched in the fall of 1945 to the Philippines.
Hmm. Is this where the situation with Magsaysay evolves?
Well, eventually. He didn't really meet Magsaysay in 45. He was there from 45 to 48 at a time when the Philippines was recovering from the ravages of World War II.
Yeah.
And so he immersed himself in Philippine society. He was fascinated by everything that he saw. He wanted to learn as much as he could. And this was when he launched the great romance of his life, which is, I think, one of the central points in the book.
Yeah, it's what makes it into a good movie someday.
Yes.
Yeah. So tell us about
from your mouth to Hollywood's ear, I hope.
Right, yeah. Well, I'm available if they need somebody. So I think, well, in order to talk about the romance, we first have to talk about Helen, his first wife.
Okay.
Okay. And then take us to Pat Kelly.
Okay. Well, in 1933, while he was living in New York, Ed Lansdale married a woman a few years older than him, Helen, who was a small-town girl from upstate New York working as a secretary in New York. And they had a couple of kids and were living out here when World War II broke out. And then he went to the Philippines in 1945. Needless to say, she didn't come with him. This was a war-torn land. And he was became very interested in the Hook Rebellion, this communist uprising involving the Hooks, H-U-K, and he wanted to find out as much as he could about them. And he ran into this very vivacious Filipino lady named Pat Kelly, whose husband of Irish Filipino ancestry had died during the war. She was a journalist. She had actually come from the same part of Luzon province as many of the Hooks. And so she served as a tour guide to him on these dangerous forays into the backcountry to meet these communist insurgents. And in the course of these adventures, a friendship developed, and before long, a romance. And this became the great love of his life, tremendously important to him, both personally and professionally. Yeah. And I was lucky enough in the course of my book to get this unprecedented vantage point on his relationship with Pat Kelly and in his inner thinking, because I tracked down Pat Kelly's granddaughter, who lives in Northern Virginia, and went to see her, and she said, "Hey, would you be interested in these letters I have in my basement?" And I said, "Boy, would I." And, you know, she had it all laid out there, the secret love letters that Ed Lansdale and Pat Kelly had written to each other over the course of decades, which nobody else had ever seen before. And then I was also lucky enough to track down Ed's boys, now in their 60s and 70s, and they shared with me the letters that he had written to their mother, Helen, often simultaneously. And so I became the first person after Ed Lansdale himself to read both sets of correspondence, and that offered an unprecedented vantage point into his innermost thinking.
Did you feel voyeuristic at all?
At times, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, the interesting thing is, initially at least, the letters to Helen, the wife, were of more interest than the ones to Pat, the mistress, because you know, in terms of describing his milieu and his work and so forth, he tended to be much more matter of fact in his letters to Helen, whereas the letters to Pat Kelly tended to be of the fairly heavy breathing variety, telling her how much he loved her and missed her and that spot behind her knee and so forth. I will add, of course, human nature being what it is, within about 10 years, the letters to Pat Kelly also became fairly factual.
Yeah. I guess he was human, but that's a very important way to get an insight into his character as a biographer. That must have been really...
It was amazing. I mean, this is not the kind of find you can reasonably expect to get in the course of a biography. I was just extraordinarily lucky to have this resource that has not been available to anybody else.
Well, what we're leading up to, of course, is his skill in assessing and strategizing how... political influence versus military influence is ultimately has to be brought into bear as we try to preserve many of these countries, like the Philippines in the late 40s and early 50s, and Vietnam in the middle, and Iraq in 2000, and so forth. But so that's the thread we're developing here with his character. So his first experience at doing that was in the Philippines, right? So I'd like you to take us through how he developed that intuition about how to help a country stabilize itself.
Well, it was really grounded in a lot of on-the-ground experience. And from 45 to 48, he was there just soaking up as much information as he could and spending time with all sorts of Filipinos, making friends, really learning the lay of the land, literally and figuratively. And then he went back again in 1950 at the behest of the CIA, charged with masterminding the defeat of the Hook Rebellion, this communist insurgency, which policymakers in Washington feared was about to overrun the country as communists had just taken over in China and were fighting in Korea and so forth. And so, you know, it starts with the fact that coming in 1950, he wasn't coming in out of left field. He really knew the country and knew the people, and he very quickly cultivated the friendship of a person who would be of central importance in his mission, Ramon Magsaysay, the newly appointed defense minister who had been a guerrilla fighter against the Japanese in World War II, was an honest, charismatic, bluff sort of guy, wanted to do the right thing, but didn't know what the right thing was. And so Lansdale, in effect, became his one-man brain trust. Mm-hmm. And together, they developed what would later become known as counterinsurgency doctrine. This was at a time when the word counterinsurgency didn't even exist. Yeah. But the basic insight that Lansdale had and that he shared with Magsaysay and then spread out to the Philippine army was that the way to defeat the insurgents was by using less force rather than more force, because he understood intuitively that the Philippine army was being counterproductive and bombarding barrios with artillery, killing lots of innocent people, and thereby creating more enemies than they eliminated. Yeah. The doctrine that Lansdale preached was treat the people as brothers, treat them with respect, protect them, and if they come to trust you, they will then rout out the insurgents in your midst. And that's the essence of counterinsurgency doctrine. And he was one of the pioneers in developing that thinking in the early 1950s.
Yeah. Now, at that time, Truman was president. And who was it? Was Dean Acheson Secretary of State at that time?
Yeah.
It was interesting to me in reading the book that they were willing to leave him alone and let him execute. Where did he get his backing in Washington in order to have that much latitude?
Well, he was a beneficiary of serendipitous circumstances, which was that the world was going to hell in a handbasket. This was
everywhere else, right?
This, remember, 1950, the Korean War was raging, and the Joint Chiefs actually drew up plans to send large U.S. Army forces to the Philippines to fight the Hooks. And under other circumstances, they might have actually done it, but the plans were not implemented because every soldier we could find had to be sent to Korea. Yeah. And so it was just the circumstances of the moment that led to this small footprint approach of relying on Ed Lansdale and a handful of secret associates. And as he started to have success, he won great backing in the Eisenhower administration, particularly from his new boss, CIA Director Alan Dulles.
When he came back to Washington after this, was he recognized for what he had achieved?
Oh, he was definitely recognized in the secret councils of government because his masterpiece was engineering Magsaysay's election as president in 1953. He was, on behalf of the CIA, he was his de facto campaign manager, including, coming up with his campaign slogan, which was Magsaysay is my guy. And so Magsaysay became known as the guy throughout the Philippines. And combined with Magsaysay's impressive reputation as this honest reformer, Lansdale's skillful advocacy of his campaign, Magsaysay won a landslide election victory in 1953 that really ended the Hook Rebellion and gave Lansdale a new nickname. He became known as Colonel Landslide. And so he came back to Washington as the fair-haired boy of Alan Dulles.
Wow. So is that when Vietnam started to heat up? Well, Dien Bien Phu, right?
Yes.
And so where was he in 1954 when that happened?
He was back in Washington as everything was heading south in Indochina. The French were losing the Battle of Dien Bien Phu. Then you had the Geneva Conference that divided Vietnam into two, into North Vietnam under Ho Chi Minh and the communists, and South Vietnam, which was supposed to be a non-communist state. But in the Eisenhower administration, people were scratching their heads, kind of wondering how can they possibly create a viable non-communist state in South Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And so when the Dulles brothers, CIA Director Alan Dulles, his brother Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, were brainstorming about how to do this, they said, well, Landslide Lansdale had some success in Southeast Asia, so why don't we send him? And so it was in the summer of 1954, Lansdale found himself in Saigon shortly after the fall of Dien Bien Phu. And his orders from Alan Dulles were word for word, do what you did in the Philippines.
Hmm. Now, when he would go there, was he going as, he wasn't going as a CIA operative, right? What was his cover?
Oh, he was a CIA operative.
No, but I mean that wasn't his public.
Oh, his cover was supposed to be the deputy air attaché, except he, you know, the actual air attaché didn't like having this guy intruding on his turf and didn't believe he was an actual colonel. So he had to prove that this was not just a cover, that he truly was a colonel in the Air Force. He was just on assignment to the CIA.
So how transportable was his experience in the Philippines to a country like Vietnam that was different politically?
Well, there were certainly some broad principles of counterinsurgency and nation building that he could take with him, but there is no question that this is a very context-specific business, and so he had a lot of learning to do, and he understood that, and he faced some barriers, including the language barrier, which was that although he had a great gift of getting along and winning the trust of foreigners, he was a typical American in that he only spoke English. And this was not a big problem in the Philippines, where a lot of people, especially the elite, spoke English. It was a bigger problem in Indochina in the 1950s when people spoke either Vietnamese or French, and so he had to work through a translator. But nevertheless, he had such a talent for getting along with people that he quickly immersed himself in Vietnamese society and made all sorts of friends, including Trinh Minh Thanh, this warlord who was denounced by the French as a terrorist and later featured prominently as the villain of Graham Greene's novel, The Quiet American. He met all sorts of sect leaders. And of course, the most important person that he met in South Vietnam, who would become his protege, much as Mok Sai Sai had been in the Philippines, was Ngo Dinh Diem.
Yeah. Tell us about him.
Ngo Dinh Diem was a Catholic Confucian Mandarin who had been a minister under the French but had quit in disgust. And so he was one of the few prominent Vietnamese who had credentials as both an anti-colonialist as well as an anti-communist. And so he was appointed prime minister of this nascent state of South Vietnam in the summer of 1954 at a time when few people imagined that he would last 9 weeks, mm-hmm. much less 9 years. Yeah. And the fact that he was able to consolidate his power owed a lot to the guidance that he received from Ed Lansdale.
Wasn't there supposed to be an election, though, right? 2 years or whatever it was, right after
yes.
Geneva?
Yes, the Geneva conference said that Vietnam was supposed to be temporarily divided. And then 2 years later, 1956, there was supposed to be a unification election. But there was little chance that the U.S. was going to allow that to happen because in all probability, Ho Chi Minh would win that election, in part because he was a popular nationalist leader, but also because he had police state control over North Vietnam, which had a greater population than South Vietnam. And so there was never any real expectation, at least on the U.S. side, that the election would happen. And in fairness, the U.S. was not actually a signatory to the Geneva Conference, so it was not legally bound to honor its terms.
And analogizing to gerrymandering, you describe how Lansdale engineered this plan to have a lot of people in North Vietnam move to South Vietnam.
Yeah, that was one of his initial major successes, was to convince 900,000 North Vietnamese, many of them Catholics, to move south, and to convince the U.S. Navy to move all those people and the South Vietnamese government to resettle them, because by so doing, he would bolster the population of South Vietnam and bring over a lot of people who are anti-communist. So, and of course, being a former admin, he loved psychological warfare, and so he bolstered the appeal with all sorts of psychological ploys, like hiring a soothsayer to predict bad fortune for North Vietnam and good fortune for South Vietnam, just to give people a little extra incentive to move south.
Was North Vietnam government aware of what was going on? I mean, this mass exodus of Catholics mostly to South Vietnam must have caught their eye.
Well, it was part of the Geneva Conference because the Geneva Conference allowed free movement between North and South over the course of the next year or so. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of Viet Minh cadres went from South Vietnam to North Vietnam for further training, and a lot of the anti-communist people in North Vietnam moved south.
Going back to discussing the differences or the similarities between the Philippines and this challenge, Philippines was one country, a fairly successful government and a revolutionary force that was basically within the country. Vietnam strikes me as having a different set of parameters because you had two countries, two leaders, the Vietnam men in South Vietnam, but also the North Vietnamese armies poised to be there as well. Did the same idea of building up Diem have the same fertile possibility as Mike Sisay?
It was, for the reasons you allude to, it was a much greater challenge. Diem had many more enemies than Mark Sisay did because he was opposed not just by the communists in the north, but the French were also opposed to him because although they were leaving South Vietnam, they didn't like the idea of turning over power to somebody who was anti-French like Diem. Mm-hmm. There were all these religious and political sects in South Vietnam who had their own private armies. So the challenges were immense, and among them was the fact that Diem did not have the same kind of winning political personality that Mok Sai Sai had, because Mok Sai Sai was a naturally earthy, you know, kind of down-to-earth guy who loved going among the people, kind of a charismatic politician, whereas Diem was very much the reserved scholarly Mandarin who liked to sit in his study reading books, but was not by natural inclination a Democrat, was not somebody who wanted to go out and mix with the hoi polloi. And so Lansdale, you know, it was much tougher. It was a much tougher environment for him to try to work his magic.
Tell us about Diem's brother, Nu, and Madam Nu.
Well, that was one of the many challenges that Lansdale faced, was the influence of Diem's brother, Ngo Dinh Nu, and his wife, the so-called Dragon Lady, Madam Nu, who were very powerful within the family and exerted an influence towards authoritarianism. Ngo Dinh Nu was educated in France, and he had these kind of conspiratorial, quasi-fascist ideas, and he tried to push the Diem regime to become kind of to turn Diem into kind of a tropical Mussolini or something like that, whereas Lansdale tried to push him in a much more democratic direction, trying to limit the authoritarianism, which he thought would backfire and would alienate the people. So there was this constant struggle going on.
Yeah.
And while Lansdale was in Vietnam from 54 to 56, he was able to keep Ngo Dinh Nu's influence in check. But once Lansdale left at the end of 1956, he wasn't replaced because nobody in the U.S. government thought it was important to have somebody like him in a position of influence with Diem. And so Ngo Dinh Nu gained a position of ascendance over his brother and pushed his regime in a more authoritarian, dictatorial direction, which ultimately led to the tragedy of 1963, the Buddhist uprising and the military coup against Diem.
In 61, that's early 61. Why didn't Kennedy, given the reputation Lansdale had, put him back into North Vietnam or South Vietnam?
Well, there was a lot of talk about doing that very thing. And when JFK took office, one of the very first documents on his desk was a report from Ed Lansdale, who had just returned from Vietnam. And this is what opened President Kennedy's eyes to the fact that we were facing a rather serious security situation in Vietnam. And the Kennedys were initially quite enamored of Ed Lansdale, who by this time was known as the prototype for the ugly American, the positive character in the ugly American, the quiet American. He was called the T. Lawrence of Asia. So he had a growing legend. And at a fateful Oval Office meeting, President Kennedy, in fact, suggested that he might send Ed Lansdale over to Vietnam as ambassador, which if he had done that, history might have been very different.
Yeah.
But as I described the meeting in the book, Lansdale was taken aback. He didn't realize he was being considered. He didn't immediately jump at it. And he sort of hesitated, and the moment passed. And then with the moment having passed, Lansdale's various bureaucratic rivals mobilized to prevent his nomination as ambassador because he made a lot of enemies in the course of his unconventional way of doing business. And so Dean Rusk supposedly threatened to resign as Secretary of State, and the possible nomination of Lansdale to be ambassador was nixed.
It's also, as I recall that period of time, Laos was also in turmoil.
Well, in fact, this was Kennedy was surprised to see the problem in Vietnam because when he had talked to President Eisenhower, Eisenhower had told him that Laos was the biggest problem that he faced in Southeast Asia. But as soon as he took office, Ed Lansdale arrived to say, no, actually, Vietnam is going to be a bigger issue, and he was surprised by that.
Yeah. But Kennedy recruited him then to be his Cuba guy.
Yes, and this was ultimately the downfall of Ed Lansdale. Very brief recap. Of course, the Kennedy administration began with the disastrous invasion of the Bay of Pigs, and the Kennedys were determined to avenge themselves on Castro because they felt he had humiliated Jack Kennedy, but they had lost confidence in the CIA, which had organized the Bay of Pigs, and so they wanted to overthrow or kill Castro. They didn't trust the agency to do it, and so they turned to the American James Bond, Ed Lansdale. And at the end of 1961, they appointed him operations director of Operation Mongoose, this top secret interagency effort to overthrow or kill Castro. Well, Lansdale very quickly ascertained the only way you were going to get rid of Castro in short order was with an American military invasion. But the Kennedys didn't want to invade Cuba. They didn't want to risk U.S. troops. What they wanted was some kind of covert action gimmick that would enable them to overthrow Castro at scant cost to themselves. And so Lansdale spent much of 1962 trying to come up with that gimmick, which, surprise, surprise, didn't exist. And the one thing that he actually did that was positive was Operation Mongoose generated the intelligence, which alerted the Kennedy administration that Nikita Khrushchev was placing nuclear missiles into Cuba. But after the Cuban missile crisis in October of 1962, Operation Mongoose was disbanded, and Ed Lansdale lost the favor of the Kennedys, and he was left naked before his bureaucratic enemies.
He lost the favor because he had failed to...
He hadn't done what they wanted, which was to snap his fingers or play a few notes from his harmonica and make Castro go up in a puff of smoke.
Huh. That seemed like a rash judgment after all he had done.
Well, they had unrealistic expectations for him, and this was his outsized reputation kind of did him in. But if you look at Ed Lansdale's track record, his successes had to do with standing up governments, with nation building in the Philippines and Vietnam. He had very little success in subverting communist dictatorships, whether in Hanoi or Havana. But people just imagine that if he could do one, he could do the other. Not so simple.
Let's fill his character out a little bit. Why did, as you say, the many of the bureaucrats, such as Dean Rusk, dislike him if he had been landslide Lansdale?
Well, there was a lot of controversy in the first place about whether a CIA officer should be getting so deeply immersed in the politics of a foreign country. There was a lot of opposition when he was orchestrating Magsaysay's campaign or orchestrating nation building in Vietnam because, for example, in the CIA, a lot of people thought their job was to steal other countries' secrets. It wasn't to engage in nation building or political liaison work. And his success threatened the State Department because they saw it was their job to work with foreign governments. And here was this interloper working for the CIA who was having more success than their diplomats were. And in fact, in several cases, he managed to get U.S. ambassadors relieved when they clashed with him. And so there were a lot of sore feelings from that. And then he didn't really have a natural bureaucratic home. I mean, he was an Air Force officer, but he was not an advocate of air power. Yeah. In fact, he said, don't use air power in insurgencies. It's counterproductive.
Yeah.
And he clashed with Robert McNamara because he resisted McNamara's attempts to reduce all the problems of war and peace to mathematical equations. Lansdale flatly told him this couldn't be done. And so he tended to be a maverick and a fearless truth teller who alienated a lot of people within the bureaucracy, and they were sharpening their knives for him for years before they finally got a chance to plunge him in after the failure of Operation Mongoose.
Hmm.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
It's a paradox, isn't it, that people who actually are successful but don't do things the way it says in the operations manual just get frozen out.
Absolutely. And something like Operation Mongoose was tremendously threatening to the CIA because, you know, the failure of the Bay of Pigs led to Allen Dulles being forced out. And, you know, if the CIA had failed at the Bay of Pigs and Ed Lansdale had succeeded in overthrowing Castro, the CIA feared they would cease to exist, that this would be such an embarrassment they couldn't survive it. And so they were doing everything they possibly could to sabotage and undermine him.
That inspires confidence.
I hate to break it to you. This is how Washington works.
Oh, my God. I better start watching this.
Not anymore, though. Now that everybody's singing Kumbaya.
Yeah. I was hoping to have a respite from that for about an hour. We may get there.
let's escape the troubles of today's world by talking about the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
That's something that'll make us feel good.
And how we learn so much. I want to go back to Diem, because you start your book, the prologue actually, with the assassination of Diem. And Lansdale was not there, won't blame him, but tell us that story about how that came about, because that may be, and I'm incorporating a lot of what you say in your book, may be the pivotal point in our tragedy in Vietnam.
Right, I suggest that it is a turning point. In 1963, Diem came into conflict with these militant Buddhists. You had Buddhist monks setting themselves on fire in the streets of Saigon, and this led to a widespread impression in the New York Times and the halls of power in Washington that Diem was so unpopular that if the U.S. was going to effectively fight communism in Vietnam, it needed a different ruler. And so this led the Kennedy administration to back a military coup against Diem. Now, Lansdale got wind of what was going on, and he strenuously warned against it because he said, you know, I know Diem, and I know the generals who want to succeed him, and I know Diem is flawed, but please send me over there. I can work with him. He is the least bad alternative we have.
Yeah.
I can get his brother Ngo Dinh Nu out of the way. I can make him more effective, whereas the generals, if they succeed, are going to be less legitimate, less effective, less honest. So please don't do this. But he was ignored, and the military coup went ahead. Actually, ironically, masterminded by Lew Conein, the CIA officer who had worked for him in the past and would again in the future. And so at the beginning of November 1963, on the very day when Lansdale, ironically, was being forcibly retired from the Pentagon as a two-star Air Force general, the coup started in Saigon, and within 24 hours, Ngo Dinh Diem and his brother Ngo Dinh Nu had been murdered.
Yeah,
this great tragedy. And the consequences were every bit as horrific as Lansdale had predicted, because the Viet Minh called this a heaven-sent gift. The Viet Cong called this a heaven-sent gift for us. They stepped up their infiltrations from the north. The government in South Vietnam all but disintegrated. You had military coup following military coup, such that by 1965, Lyndon Johnson decided he had to send American combat troops, which was the last thing that Ed Lansdale ever wanted to see. And subsequently, observers as diverse as Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon were to say that the anti-Diem coup was the biggest mistake we made in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And as the Pentagon Papers pointed out, this effectively Americanized the war because we had so destabilized South Vietnam. We took ownership of the war effort, which again was the last thing that Ed Lansdale wanted to see.
Well, it also destroyed the transportability of the model from the Philippines, where you could take a leader in your country and build up enough political support around him that he could actually have a government.
Right. It became very difficult because then you had one military dictator following another.
And, yeah. Couple of months period.
Yes, right. Yeah. Very, very quickly. Yeah. And all the generals and district and province governors were turning over as well. So it was a very chaotic situation.
There's I recommend, after you've read this book, there's a series of 45-minute long interviews with Ed Lansdale that are on YouTube, and he talks about this, and he says something very interesting. He said, I tried to explain to our leaders that they should not be looking for George Washington in how we pick our leadership in countries we're trying to stabilize. I thought that was an interesting way of thinking about it. I mean, it's almost like he was able to take our revolutionary history and transport it into a practical analysis of don't set your hopes too high.
Yeah, I mean, he was a great devotee of the founding fathers. He loved the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence. He was not a great student, and his life should certainly give inspiration to see students everywhere. But he was a great devotee of the founding, and he tried to take those ideals with him when he was in Asia.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a mixed bag because he actually encouraged Diem to be the father of his country and to emulate some of George Washington's practices in terms of being a liberal democratic ruler, not becoming a dictator, giving up power when the time came,
yeah,
and so forth. And obviously that was that tough sell.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, in 1963, although he was upset with some of Diem's dictatorial practices, he didn't think that the perfect should be the enemy of the good. And as a, you know, he basically yeah. calculated that ZM was the best hope that we had, even though he was decidedly flawed and imperfect.
Well, and the subsequent events certainly proved that.
Yeah, exactly.
Another thing he says...
I mean, if I could just very briefly point out, I mean, it was striking to me watching the Ken Burns PBS documentary, which kind of echoes the conventional wisdom about Vietnam, which I think is a little bit incoherent on the subject of ZM, because invariably ZM is depicted as a very bad guy mm-hmm. who had lost the support of his people, a completely illegitimate ruler. A lot of people think he was corrupt, which was not the case at all. He was actually very ascetic. But then... The paradox lurking in plain sight is, okay, if ZM was so bad, why is it that overthrowing ZM actually made the situation worse, not
yeah,
better?
Right.
And people don't stop to think about that.
Well, that's an interesting syllogism. You know?
Yeah.
Another thing he said that I found really interesting was, he says, the basic geopolitical unit in Vietnam is the village. And our strategy of trying to go in there and create top-down centrist governments, when the villages don't even trust each other. The villages were xenophobic vis-a-vis each other, and we never seemed to get that idea.
Yeah, Lansdale definitely wanted to work from the rice roots up, and one of the things that ZM did after he left in 1956, which was very destructive and he was very upset about, was that ZM canceled the district election, the village elections, and had the village elders appointed by the central government along with the district and province governors. And Lansdale instantly recognized this was going to be a disaster, because if the villagers had a chief whom they didn't like, they wanted some kind of democratic way, peaceful way of getting rid of him. And if they didn't have that peaceful way, they would get rid of him by asking the Viet Cong to kill him.
Yeah.
And so Lansdale understood that this was going to be very corrosive to central authority, because it was basically giving the central government ownership of every problem mm-hmm. at the local level, and preventing villagers from having... from having any kind of accountability yeah. From their local leaders.
And they frankly didn't, according to what he said and what you wrote, they didn't care who the government was. They just cared who was in their village and who wasn't in their village. And,
right.
And
yeah, I mean, that was something that Lansdale said pretty consistently throughout the 60s was that... most Vietnamese really just wanted to be left alone. They had no desire to be governed by the communists, mm-hmm. but they also didn't want to become cannon fodder in this bloody war. They just wanted to be left alone.
Yeah.
And what he said consistently, Lansdale said, was, you know, the key question for the U.S. as it wages this war, and earlier than that for the South Vietnamese Army, the ARVN, the Army of the Republic of Vietnam, is what do you do about this poor rice farmer standing in his fields who just wants to be left alone? Is he going to be protected and nurtured and cherished, or is he going to become collateral damage in our yeah. attempts to wipe out the Viet Cong? And of course, it was the latter.
Yeah. Is it fair to attribute to him the term hearts and minds?
Well, the actual term is generally attributed to Field Marshal Templer, the British commander in Malaya in the early 1950s, at the same time that Lansdale was working in the Philippines, and they were working along parallel lines and developing many of the same ideas. Mm. But I think it's fair to say that, you know, Lansdale was certainly an exemplar of the hearts and minds philosophy,
yeah.
which essentially means that the way you defeat an insurgency is not by trying to bomb it into oblivion, as General William Westmoreland tried to do. The way you defeat an insurgency is by offering a better alternative to the people so that they want to support your government rather than the alternative right. being offered by the insurgents.
Well, the title of your book is The Road Not Taken, to also attribute another quote. So take us through your thinking about how Lansdale is a pivot point in that intersection of The Road Not Taken.
Well, Lansdale was a fascinating character on many levels, not least because he was there in Vietnam on and off throughout the whole history of our involvement from 1954 right up through 1968, and he was there during the Tet Offensive and left some months later in the summer of 1968. And what he consistently argued from during the 1960s, and you know, in the 1950s, he'd had a fair amount of success in implementing his ideas, but then in the 1960s, he became the odd man out and increasingly ignored by the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, because again, he argued that we were not going to bomb this revolution into oblivion, that the only way to win yeah. was to try to foster a stable, legitimate, popular, non-corrupt government in Saigon that could win the support of its people, and he was consistently ignored with his advice. Road not taken, I'm suggesting that there was an alternative path. Now, of course, this is counterfactual history, and we don't know, cannot know what would have happened if Lansdale had been listened to, and I certainly can't sit here and say that if he had prevailed, that we would have prevailed, that we would have necessarily won the war, because North Vietnam would certainly have been a formidable adversary under any circumstances with more will to win than we had. But of one thing I'm pretty certain, which is that if Lansdale had been listened to, we would not have lost 58,000 Americans in Vietnam. We would not have had millions of Vietnamese killed in the crossfire, because he never wanted to see this bloody big unit conventional war with 500,000 Americans thrashing around the jungles of South Vietnam. He was always opposed to that approach.
Well, I can see why he didn't get along with McNamara.
They were like oil and water.
Both not just personally, but conceptually.
Yes.
Well, tell the story about him going into McNamara's office.
Well, this was in early 1961. Of course, McNamara had just come over from running the Ford Motor Company, graduate of the Harvard Business School, and I should add, in fairness of my alma mater, UC Berkeley, a guy who was enamored of systems analysis, of numbers, and thought that these mathematical equations would hold the key to all the important questions that he faced. Lansdale, not so bright academically, UCLA dropout, but he had spent years in Southeast Asia, and so he tried to begin the education of Robert McNamara by bringing back with him from a trip to Vietnam some captured Viet Cong weaponry, some very simple rifles and pistols all covered in mud and blood, and he walked into McNamara's office and dumped these weapons on his immaculate desk and said, "Mr. Secretary, these are the weapons that are being used by our adversaries in Vietnam. They're not very sophisticated, and the people who use these weapons, you wouldn't even recognize them as soldiers, although they think of themselves that way. They wear black pajamas and have rubber sandals, but they are licking the soldiers on our side who are equipped with all the best gear that the U.S. Army can provide, because the Viet Cong have the power of an ideal, the power of an idea, and the only way we're going to beat them is by offering a stronger ideal, a better idea to the people of South Vietnam. We're not going to bomb this revolution into oblivion." And hindsight, I would say pretty wise advice, but McNamara was invincibly armored in his ignorance and arrogance, and so chose to disregard what Ed Lansdale had to say because he was not one of the best and brightest.
Well, it wasn't reducible to metrics. Also.
Yes, yes. In fact, When McNamara tried to reduce the war to mathematical equations, Lansdale told him, "Don't forget the X factor." And McNamara started writing on his graph paper, "X factor." And he said, "Okay, how do I calculate that?" And Lansdale said, "Well, unfortunately, you can't calculate it, because it's the feelings of the people. It's their sentiments about how they want to be governed. That's the most important factor, and you can't reduce it to numbers." Well, McNamara didn't appreciate that.
Well, that was probably the end of their conversations.
It really was. Yeah. McNamara didn't want to hear from him after that.
I think that if I were to try to synthesize the thrust of several of these questions, it's how we take the lessons of Vietnam, call it a tragedy, and I'll use that word, and bring them forward into the 21st century. And with our Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, who knows what's next?
Well, we are, of course, engaged today in another great counterinsurgency, this time not against communist insurgents as in Lansdale's day, this time against Islamist insurgents. And if you think about, how are we going to win the war on terror, I would submit we're probably not going to win with American combat troops. We're not going to send hundreds of thousands of soldiers to occupy the greater Middle East. Been there, done that, tried it, didn't like it, probably not going to do it again anytime soon. So if we're not going to win the war with American combat troops, how are we going to win the war? So when we win the war, I think it's going to be with American advisors, by sending small teams of military, diplomatic, intelligence personnel to work with local frontline states to defeat our common enemies, much in the way that we just did in fighting ISIS in Iraq and Syria. And if you think about advisors, you have to think about Ed Lansdale, who is one of the most storied advisors of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And I think he has a lot of lessons to teach, some positive, some negative. It wasn't all good, but I think he needs to be studied. And especially his success in winning over foreign leaders like Ramon Magsaysay and Ngo Dinh Diem, that's something we could use more of, because in fact, some of the biggest problems we've had in Iraq and Afghanistan have come when we've become at odds with our local allies like Hamid Karzai or Nouri al-Maliki, we didn't have somebody who was a leadership whisperer like Ed Lansdale who could gently steer them in the right direction. And so we got into these very counterproductive confrontations, much as we did with CM in the early 60s after Lansdale left Vietnam. So we could use somebody with his talent for empathy. He's somebody who basically mobilized emotional intelligence and sent it marching into battle. And that's a skill set which is not kind of a normal military skill set, but it's actually in many ways more important than the normal military skills.
Well, it strikes me that as I visualize this concept, that your leading exponent of that kind of a policy would be in the State Department. And where you want to have a secondary position is in the military, because you're really not interested in shock and awe and fire and fury. You're interested in the political strategies. Do we have a government now that is focusing itself, its priorities in that direction?
That's a rhetorical question, right?
Yes. Very.
You remember who's president, right? I don't think diplomacy is a big priority for President Trump. And in fact, we're seeing the State Department now be devastated by Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. They're losing an entire generation of foreign service officers. Great tragedy in the making. And already the State Department had many fewer resources than the Pentagon, and the imbalance is becoming even greater. But by all indications, you know, President Trump doesn't care, because as I've said before, when it comes to soft power, he is rapidly practicing unilateral disarmament.
Mm-hmm. But let's take David Petraeus, right? I mean, he wrote the book on counterinsurgency. Are there not voices inside the government who are putting forth the what we'll call the Lansdale Doctrine?
Well, there are. And in fact, even Jim Mattis, the Secretary of Defense, has been quoted on numerous occasions as saying, you know, we need more spending and support for the State Department. Otherwise, he's going to need more money for bullets. But again, that is not a point of view. That is one favor in this administration, which looks at the world in a kind of very hostile way and in a very confrontational fashion. I mean, it's interesting because I started this book in 2013 when, you know, yeah. If you told me that Donald Trump was going to become president, yeah. I would have said that's a bad science fiction movie right there. So I never had him in mind when I was writing, but it's kind of striking to me the extent to which he is the anti-Ed Lansdale, because Lansdale believed in engaging with foreign countries with empathy, with understanding, winning people's trust, winning their friendship, being very humble in his approach. And that's pretty much the opposite of the Donald Trump approach, which is very bombastic and consists of, you know, flinging nasty tweets against various countries and entire and making, you know, dismissive comments about entire continents, which makes the job of U.S. diplomacy, of soft power, of winning hearts and minds, never easy in the best of times, becoming nearly impossible today, I would say.
Well, we hear the phrase nation building a lot. Is nation building on the out or is it on the in right now?
Well, it's always on the out. Nobody likes nation building. This is one of the few things that President Obama and President Trump could agree on. And I think part of the reason nation building has gotten a bad reputation is because it's associated with the war in Iraq. But in fact, there's another kind of nation building, the kind that Ed Lansdale did, yeah. Where it didn't involve sending hundreds of thousands of troops. It involved sending about a dozen very skilled advisors who could work with the locals and empower them. And that's the kind of nation building I think we need more of, because that's the kind of nation building that will avoid American troop deployments in the future.
Maybe we need to come up with a new word.
I've tried. It's state building is technically accurate. I've suggested in the past that we need a Department of Peace Operations, but it's a tough sell in Washington, because anything associated with nation building is anathema. And so you see, you know, Trump tweeting these somewhat made up claims that we've wasted $7 trillion in the Middle East or something yeah. like that. We're going to waste a lot more unless we can figure out how to nurture more stable and legitimate states, because otherwise they're going to be chaotic, lawless, and a breeding ground of more terrorism. And no matter how many terrorists we kill, there are going to be more to replace them.
Well, what about Pakistan? I mean, we're slapping their hand now, right? Is that another example of what you're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, that's we haven't had much success in influencing Pakistan in a positive direction, which admittedly is very hard to do. And so we're kind of throwing up our hands in disgust and cutting off a lot of the military aid. I mean, I don't object to it per se, because there's no question Pakistan has been duplicitous, because while they have been taking our money and helping us with some counterterrorism missions, they've also been supporting the Taliban and the Haqqanis, who have been killing a lot of people in Afghanistan. But I don't have any hope that cutting off the aid is going to do much good, because the Chinese will just step into the vacuum. Yeah. And Pakistan is not going to change their fundamental foreign policy objectives based on $1 billion of U.S. funding. So it's not going to achieve the results that we want.
It's kind of what I was driving at, I guess, is it seems that by this new policy of withdrawing diplomatic integration and stressing the strength of our military to the extent that we're even going to build it up more, and withdrawing from any multilateral treaties of consequence or threatening to, we're just creating a space for other countries to move in, China being the most obvious.
Absolutely true.
That was not a question.
If you could explain that to President Trump, you would be doing a whole lot of good for the country. But I think that's absolutely true. I mean, I think he views foreign relations in this very narrow prism, like a real estate deal where one guy gets the better of the other guy. Mm-hmm. He doesn't understand the idea of win-win. He doesn't understand the idea that U.S. power since 1945 has been based on the support of allies all over the world who see us as a selfless and disinterested champion of the common good, as a country that stands up for democracy and freedom, with, you know, Trump's me first philosophy, which translates into America first. It becomes a dog eat dog world, where you have a breakdown of alliances, you have a breakdown of trust, you have a breakdown of international law. I'm not saying all this has happened in the last year, but You know, Rome wasn't burned in a day. It's going to take a little while, but that's kind of the trend that we're on.
Yeah. Well, that ties back to another question here, which is, should we be relying on a democratic form of government in countries that we're trying to stabilize, or do we need to kind of get over the notion that we're going to save the world for democracy?
Well, we've often gotten over that notion. I mean, we've supported a lot of dictatorships over the years in a lot of different countries. And Lansdale argued that sometimes it was necessary. I mean, he thought that we needed to stay behind Diem, because he didn't, in part because he didn't see a democratic alternative. It was just going to be a military dictatorship. And so sometimes you have to, choose the least bad option. But he thought that we were going too far in kind of the cynical, amoral realpolitik direction, because these dictatorships would often lose the support of their people. But I would say, based on my observations over the years, I would say more important than whether a government is a democracy or not is it effective? Is it honest? How corrupt is it?
Yeah.
I think those are the things that really determine the extent to which people support the regime. And there are some, reasonably effective autocracies in the world, not many, a few, but I mean, Singapore is often held up as a model. Mm-hmm. But even, countries like Jordan, unelected king, certainly better than the alternatives. So there are certainly countries where, Iraq has been an ostensible democracy, but very unstable. And, the electoral process has often resembled a census, because people vote based on their ethnic sectarian group. So, I think the challenge in all these countries is to have government that's accountable and not terribly corrupt. And I do think that at least a modicum of democracy can be helpful in that, because you do get some feedback and you allow the replacement of officials peaceably instead of developing just a complete dictatorship that runs roughshod over the people. But that's, we should be thinking about how to create more legitimate and accountable governance of whether it's democratic or not.
Well, let me pin that down. Where should that thinking be being done, and where should that policy be happening?
Well, I think it's core to American foreign policy, but it's the kind of thinking that doesn't often happen in Washington, and should happen more, I think. And we don't have a we don't have people who are really focused on improving foreign governance. I mean, it's interesting because the Army has actually taken an initiative now to create something called SFABs, these Security Force Assistance Brigades, that are the first dedicated units designed for the military advisory mission, which I think is a great thing because military advisors in the past have been kind of the abandoned stepchildren of the military. But while we have these military advisors, the question I would ask is, where are the political advisors? Where are the people to mentor foreign heads of state and other officials and to work with them and to try to help them to make their governments more effective? That's really a capability which is MIA and the U.S. government, and it's one that I think we need to develop because I think, you know, we could use a cadre of Ed Lansdales, people who are knowledgeable about various foreign societies and can work sympathetically in those societies to try to improve their governance in ways that would be congruent with American interests.
In that regard, since 1948, if I have my history correct, we've had the United Nations. Is that institution still relevant, or do we need to invent new systems for what you've been talking about, I mean, internationally?
Well, I think the United Nations is still relevant. I think it's an important place to have a international dialogue, and they do some useful and important things, you know, with, you know, protecting monuments with UNESCO and some peacekeeping missions that I think do some good.
Health.
Yeah, they have some valuable programs. I mean, there's also a lot of corruption and, you know, abuse of power by peacekeepers and other problems that need to be dealt with. I mean, I think they're useful, but they're not, they don't really perform this nurturing function either. They're not leadership whisperers. They're not good governance promoters per se. And so that's still a capability. It doesn't all have to be the U.S. I mean, other countries like the U.K., France, Germany, and others can and do some of that as well, but it's a need that needs to be addressed.
What do you see the solution for Syria to be?
How long do you have? I don't see a lot of obvious solutions to Syria.
I can leave, but you can for you say.
I hope I'm not telling you anything you don't know when I say that Syria is a bloody mess, and there's no obvious way out. We've had some temporary success in depriving Islamic State of their territory in Syria and Iraq, but we don't know what to do next. And this goes back to kind of the Ed Lansdale insight that it's always going to be the political line of operations, which is decisive. And that will, whether you have success in building up a political regime determines whether you can translate your tactical military gains into long-term strategic success. And I just don't see any kind of plan in Syria, or for that matter, in Iraq, to translate our tactical military gains into longer-term success. And in fact, we're already running into massive problems because we backed the Kurds to defeat ISIS, but now the Turks, our NATO allies, are fighting the Kurds, and the Russians and the Iranians are backing Assad, and he's trying to conquer the rest of the country. We still have a few thousand troops and advisors in Syria, but we don't really know what to do with them. We don't really know what our policy is. There's no real game plan for bringing about peace in Syria. And so, you know, my fear is that our success against the Islamic State may prove transitory.
And the reason I bring this up is not just to talk about current events, but the thread of Ed Lansdale's teaching weaves, it seems to me, through all of these issues about the choice of heavy military footprint over working at the political level to stabilize. Is that a fair summary of?
I think it is, and we always have a predilection for military action because that's what we're good at. We have a technological advantage. We like to use air power, and you know it's not that hard for us to kill individual terrorists. The difficulty is to translate, to move from killing individual insurgents to killing a wholesale insurgency. Right. And it's very hard to get from here to there because, as Ed Lansdale said, ultimately the way you win is through politics, through government, by offering a better alternative to the people. And that's much harder to do. We're not that good at it. We don't want to do it. It's nation building. It's stuff we want to stay away from. And so we kind of tend to revert to our comfort zone, which is kinetic military action. And then we're surprised when we don't achieve the long-term results that we hope for.
It plays good at home. I remember when W. Bush was talking about the potential of invading Iraq, the term shock and awe was there to kind of juice up all of our patriotic pride. And it was as though every problem was a nail for us.
I think that's absolutely right. Again, that's what we're good at, but and we're not that interested in translating those battlefield gains into longer-lasting success. We did have some success in Iraq and with the surge in 2007-2008 because General Petraeus and Ambassador Crocker were much more cognizant of the need for political action, and the decisive line of operations in the surge was really reconciling the Sunni tribesmen with the Shiite government in Baghdad. That's what enabled the success of the surge, but then we became complacent, pulled our troops out, thought that Iraq could handle it on their own, and as a result, you had the rise of ISIS. So, you know, it's not a happy story. One of the quotes from Ed Lansdale that I have in the book is that, you know, he said, "I despair of Americans ever learning the simplicity of fighting a political war," because he denounced our technological approach to warfare in the 50s and 60s and our tendency to come in with this massive logistical footprint to build up these vast bases in foreign countries that completely distort their politics and economy. And, you know, he said, let's keep it simple, small scale. Let's focus on political warfare. But as I said, he, based on his experience, despaired of our willingness to do that. And I must say that succeeding decades have only reinforced that message of despair.
Well, since we're talking about the movie plot here, let's end this with on a positive note, because we left off with Pat Kelly and Helen Lansdale as ships in the night, writing letters back and forth. Tell us what eventually happened to make Ed Lansdale a happy guy.
Ed Lansdale and Pat Kelly pursued this romance of theirs for roughly a decade, from the mid-40s to the mid-50s, and then they remained friends thereafter. And then finally, in the early 1970s, Ed's wife, Helen, passed away. And by Pat Kelly still living in Manila, just retired from the U.S. Embassy, had never remarried. And so she almost immediately moved to the United States. They rekindled their romance. On July 4th of 1973, they got married. And they lived happily ever after in their little home in Northern Virginia until Ed Lansdale's own death from natural causes in 1987.
Yeah. So it had a nice, happy ending. Yeah.
They lived happily ever after. Right. The state of South Vietnam did not have such a happy ending.
No, and he didn't have to watch 21st century foreign policy. I want to thank you, Max, very much on behalf of our audience. And there will be book signing, and I highly recommend this book. It's fixating to read. And then I recommend you watch those YouTube videos of Ed Lansdale talking. It's fascinating to hear the man and articulating these ideas. So I thank you very much. It was a pleasant evening for you.
Thanks.
Thank you.